Welcome to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy podcast. Get inspired. Break through to new dimensions with your entrepreneurial peers on the path to self-leadership mastery and life success. Redefine how you lead as you redesign your business. I call this dual innovation leadership. Take charge of who you next become. Feel more deeply to think, act, lead, and mentor more clearly and effectively. Discover something new from our meaningful conversation today. Welcome to We Mentor Mondays. I'm Nancy. Today's sponsor is Midwest Bakery, and I'm excited to tell you about their delicious, all-natural halal bread. I'm so jazzed about their bread products that I'm helping them grow their bakery. They follow the Muslim definition of halal, H-A-L-A-L, ensuring their bread and hoagie rolls use only permissible ingredients. So check out MidwestBakeryHalal.com to find a store near you. Remember, you don't need to be Muslim to enjoy their food. If they're not in a grocer near you, talk to the store director and request it. After all, grocers want to stock products that you love to eat. Are you curious to learn how human behavior and where the law intersect? If yes, check out today's episode, number 382, What We Need to Know About Forensic Psychiatry with Dr. Mark
Levy
by Part 1. Trust me, it's worth your time. To give you a little background, Dr. Mark Levy is a licensed clinical and forensic psychiatrist with over four decades of experience. He is a graduate of Columbia University and the San Francisco Psychoanalytic Institute. Dr. Levy has been certified by the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology and the National Board of Physicians and Surgeons. He is an associate clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco, and an adjunct associate professor of psychiatry at Stanford University School of Medicine. Dr. Levy and his team of 22 board-certified psychiatrists and 10 forensic neuropsychologists, I know it's a mouthful, practice forensic psychiatry at Forensic Psychiatric Associates LP, or you can also go to fpamed.com. Dr. Levy has been retained as a forensic psychiatric expert in more than 500 civil lawsuits and related matters. He has published numerous articles and presented countless talks on forensic psychiatric topics such as mental illness in the workplace and shrink in the courtroom, forensic psychiatry and law. Dr. Mark Levy, thank you for joining me today to discuss forensic psychiatry. Is it okay if I refer to you as Mark?
Absolutely, Nancy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, good. Great. Well, we've got a lot to talk about and unpack. I'm not as familiar with forensic psychiatry as you probably noticed in the questions that I initially sent you. So it's good to dive in. I'm not alone. There's a lot of people who don't understand the field. So if you could start with, what is the definition of forensic psychiatry?
Sure. And let me just say first, the reason that we go by FPA is it is such a mouthful, forensic psychiatric associates, forensic psychologists, et cetera. So FPA is much easier for people to pronounce and remember. What I encounter most often, and my colleagues do as well, is that people say, what is forensic psychiatry? Because they're used to seeing a forensic pathologist on television and they don't see what does psychiatry have to do with dead bodies? It seems with autopsies, it seems like it has nothing to do with that. And why are you putting these two together? Actually, forensic means the law. It doesn't mean dead bodies or autopsies. A forensic pathologist, like a coroner, figures out what was the cause of death. But that's the forensic part of that doesn't mean bodies. It means law.
Oh, got it. Yeah, that's a good distinction. Yeah. Important one.
Forensic psychiatry is the interface of law and psychiatry. And although physicians and psychologists, other professionals, are called as experts in litigation regularly, the only medical specialty that has training and board certification in the law and that subspecialty of medicine is psychiatry. In order to become a board certified forensic psychiatrist, you need to complete a 1-year full-time fellowship after you're a psychiatrist. And then that makes you eligible to take the board exam. And there are fewer than 2,000 active board certified forensic psychiatrists in the US, but around 50,000 active board certified psychiatrists. And everyone in our group is board certified, at least in both psychiatry and forensic psychiatry. We have a few people who are also child and adolescent psychiatrists, have boards in that, or boards in substance abuse and addiction, or boards in neuropsychiatry. But the key thing is forensic psychiatric boards, at least in terms of credentialing. And the forensic psychiatry subspecialty, which, as I said, is the interface of law and psychiatry, is very interesting because, amongst other things, we have to be bilingual in medicine. I don't mean bilingual Spanish English.
You mean in the language of the law.
Yeah. The law has a large body of statutes and precedents, including many Supreme Court precedents, that address questions of behavior, but they use or they concoct their own terms, which are not necessarily medical terms. The most glaring example is not guilty by reason of insanity. That's a basis for someone not to be tried for the crime of murder. Usually it can be applied to anything. It could be applied to petty theft, but it's usually not invoked except in murder cases. But insanity is a legal term. It's not a medical term. Psychosis is the medical term, and these are not equivalent.
Yeah.
It becomes important if you're going to work in this space of law and behavioral medicine to understand what they mean, and then to also at times be able to say, well, I can speak to what the medical aspects are, but I can't speak to your legal definition. I'm not a lawyer, et cetera, et cetera. And that becomes important. I'll give you an example. First of all, the forensic psychiatry is divided into civil and criminal, just like the law is. So, and there are different tasks for a forensic psychiatrist in civil and criminal. I'll go back to that, but let me just skip ahead to the point I was trying to make. So an area of civil law is probate law, which is wills and estates, and there's litigation called will contests, usually brought by family members or former beneficiaries of the will or trust. Usually it's a trust of a person who's died, a decedent, and they claim that the person changed their will at the end of their life when they no longer had capacity to make those changes. It's called testamentary capacity in the law. Or they were subjected to undue influence, also a legal term, not a medical term. And so when we are asked to opine about questions of testamentary capacity and or undue influence, an aspect of this that has to do with being a medical expert, not a lawyer or judge, is that whether or not the person was influenced unduly is what's called in the law, in quotes, an ultimate question. That means it's a question for the trier of fact, which is often in will contests, just a judge. There's no jury. Sometimes there's a jury trial. You can have a jury trial, but frequently it's in a probate court in front of a probate judge who's a specialist in that area of the law. And so he is the one who decides what is true, what is factually true, what is false. So it's very important when one writes an opinion or gives testimony to say, these were the influences that I observed according to the statute or whatever it is that defines in that state the definitions of undue influence. But it's beyond an expert's authority to determine whether these were undue or due. You know, if you have a wife of 25 years influencing the decisions of how the person who died, say the husband, is going to distribute their assets to the kids or to whomever, that may be due, that may be appropriate, that may not be the kind of manipulation that comes up when an old man with a young female caregiver who's worked for 6 months suddenly takes him to a lawyer and has him change his estate and give it only to her. That is suspicious. It doesn't pass the smell test. There's been undue influence exerted on this person. And there's all kinds of criteria for what are the influences and what is the vulnerability to undue influence. And so usually in those areas, forensic psychiatrists opine about vulnerability to undue influence. I'll take a breath here to give you a chance.
I can see where there's a lot of sorting out between language, between the medical profession and also the psychiatry and the law. Right. So how does this practice, I think it's good to differentiate also further, differ from, say, the practice of clinical psychiatry?
Yes.
Because you must get that a lot.
It's a really good, really, really good question, which often even attorneys don't fully appreciate to their detriment in litigating a case. There's very, very different roles that a treating doctor of any kind, including a psychiatrist who's a physician, let me just say that because sometimes people don't know. A psychiatrist is someone who's gone to college and 4 years of medical school and 4 years of residency in psychiatry, just like someone who does a residency in general surgery.
I didn't realize it was 4 years for residency. Wow.
Yeah, it used to be a year of general internship. In my generation, that's what I did, a rotating medical internship and then 3 years of residency. But now it's 4 years. Psychiatrists are physicians. Psychologists usually have doctoral level degrees. They too are licensed by the state, just as physicians are, in which they work. But their typical training is a graduate school in psychology up to a doctoral degree and all that's required for that, which is usually a thesis, et cetera. And then they have postdoc requirements to in a sense, intern with a trained licensed psychologist. And they, depending on the state, there's a different number of hours, but it's usually, you know, 1,000 or multiple hours of that of apprenticeship that they have to fulfill in order to get licensed in that state as a psychologist. So it's, although it overlaps in content, some of the material, it's a very different road. The one important, there are distinctions. Psychiatrists being physicians can prescribe. The psychologists in most jurisdictions cannot because they don't have a medical education. Psychologists do have very detailed training and education in psychological testing and in statistics that underlie psychological testing. And so the reason that we have in our group 10 forensic neuropsychologists, they've had advanced training not just in psychology, but in the brain and cognition and things that become a problem if someone has had a traumatic brain injury or if they're demented and their cognition falls apart. So they are skilled at administering and scoring tests of cognitive functioning in addition to psychological functioning. So we have different complementary but different expertise, and that's the reason that we have a group of experts in that area in our team, in our practice, because we rely heavily on their test data. And if I could just say one more thing about that.
Yeah, go ahead. Sure.
This is a weird aspect of the law, and I'm quite certain, I'm not a lawyer, but I think this is correct, that in all jurisdictions, meaning in all 50 states, because states have different laws, this is true. And that is that an expert opinion is offered at a level of proof in a trial of called preponderance of the evidence. That's 50% in a feather. That means it's more probable than not, in my opinion, that X or Y is true. Hmm. The trial could be a criminal trial where guilt needs to be beyond a reasonable doubt. That's 95% certainty. So often, and I'm not aware of judges giving this instruction, which I think they should, to the jury. The jury is making a decision weighing all the evidence, the psychiatric testimony or other, a ballistics expert testimony, any other expert testimony, is the evidence in part that they're weighing, not just the testimony of the defendant or whatever. But the evidence they're weighing is more true than not. It's not true beyond a reasonable doubt, even though they need to be sure beyond a reasonable doubt when they say this person is guilty, or it's not beyond a reasonable doubt, and they'll say they cannot say that he or she is guilty. So it's an interesting sort of slippage in the system of rules that the law uses.
If we look at just the case of O.J. Simpson, and that was such a weird, strange case because it was presented or played out in L.A. Right. And there was so much contention going on with just the riots that had happened who was that was beaten?
Rodney King.
Yeah. Rodney King. And reviewing the O.J. Simpson case now, he just passed away this year. So they had some, a documentary on what happened during that time. And they added in kind of the legacy of what built up to the O.J. Simpson case. And what are your thoughts about the jury in that situation?
Well, what you're saying is the jury in a trial is influenced by the times and the events in the times surrounding the trial. Also, the trial may be 2 years after the crime. It may have been a different reality when the crime happened from when the jury is hearing the case. Well, I'm not sure what the delay was between the murder of O.J. Simpson's wife and his trial. I don't remember that part. But
I think it was 2 years, 2 years after Rodney King had been beaten.
Okay. L.A. was in uproar in the riots in Compton, et cetera. So what you're saying is, hey, doesn't all that stuff influence and is what the law calls prejudicial one way or the other? In this case, it would be prejudicial against the police, against the government, against the prosecution.
You could feel the anger toward the police just in general.
And O.J. Simpson's attorney was very good. Trial attorneys are performing on a stage. It's theater. And they're not just actors. They are also producers and directors. And they're very good at the theater. Very successful trial attorneys are very good at the theater of drama and of influencing other people. That's what it's their skill set. And we have an adversarial legal system where each side gets to argue its side of the case. That's not the only kind of legal system in Europe. They have the Napoleonic system where a panel of judges decides, and it's not a jury of peers, and there's no room for theatrics there. And so it becomes a matter of, in some senses, it's better because you need, the facts are essential, whereas the facts can get lost due to Rodney King and other factors in the O.J. Simpson trial, that is the science and whatever the evidence was. But on the other hand, when you have a panel of three elevated judges who may all be upper class in a society that is class structured, they're not necessarily representative of the defendant, and they may have a very different set of social biases, et cetera, from the defendant. So in that sense, it's inferior to our system because it's not a jury of peers. In any case, getting back to O.J. Simpson, the jury had, I forget what percentage, but a significant number of African-Americans in the jury. And they were furious with, and it had all kinds of other nuances to it. Not only was O.J. Simpson an early Black celebrity, someone who had really succeeded when most African-Americans have a very hard time, he was married to a white woman, which is at best ambivalence producing in African-American, particularly African-American women at that time.
That was his second wife, Nicole Brown Simpson.
Yep. Right. Yep. Yeah. That becomes, a loss of a good Black man to the community of Black women. The white women who always win anyway. So, that's the kind of set of assumptions. So that certainly colors. However, having said all that, people will have different opinions about whether the O.J. Simpson jury went badly astray or whether they didn't, or whether it wasn't proven beyond a reasonable doubt, which does not mean that he's innocent. It means he's not guilty. That's a very different distinction,
Right.
95% proof is required to convict someone. It doesn't mean that if it was 90% or 83% that they were innocent. It just means that it wasn't proven to beyond to that standard of proof.
Yeah. And I think Mark Furman, being a police officer and also having a history of racism, brought out the anger.
Right.
In the whole country.
Right.
Yeah. And they really played into it. And I just feel like in so many cases when people are involved in the legal system, and yes, you're trying to get representation and fair representation, and everybody should have representation and also the resources to, present their case. I just find that many times the truth gets lost.
Yes. We have at least as large a celebrity cases going on right now with the former president. So
yes, yeah, and how you sort out the politics of all that when he, the past president has been very skilled at finding the weaknesses in our legal system and exploiting them. I mean, that's what really good entrepreneurs do in any case, but he's got this mindset. Do you feel like he has psychopathic tendencies?
Well, that's a loaded question because there's an ethical duty.
Yeah, you can't diagnose.
There have been a group of psychiatrists who have, this is a very interesting subject. It's called the Goldwater Rule.
Okay.
When Barry Goldwater ran for president, there were a bunch of psychiatrists who said he was paranoid and therefore unfit to be president. They said more than that, but that was the essence of it.
Yeah.
And after Barry Goldwater lost the election, he actually sued those psychiatrists and won. And the American Psychiatric Association instituted the Goldwater Rule, which is that you cannot diagnose people you haven't examined.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of interesting use of psychiatric diagnostic terminology in history. Was Lincoln depressed? Well, nobody alive today examined Lincoln.
No, that's interesting too. Yeah.
Yeah, but with caveats like that, you cannot diagnose a person you haven't examined who's alive, certainly. And there are exceptions that come up in forensic contexts where you're being asked to offer a diagnostic opinion. We'll just take what I said, the probate cases. So someone is dead.
Yeah.
Can't be examined. They can't be given neurocognitive tests. One has to look at the medical records and infer from that, with the declaration that I haven't examined this person, this is based on a medical records review, what do you think the pattern that we call diagnosis that you can recognize in the symptoms and in the course of the illness, et cetera, the decedent may have had? With Barry Goldwater, that wasn't done. With Donald Trump, nobody has seen his medical records, and he's there's no evidence he's ever had any psychiatric evaluation, you know, where somebody has said, now that said, he meets all the criteria for psychopathy, for antisocial personality disorder. But it's the traditional role is it's stepping over the line. Here's what's interesting. I think during the Trump administration, there was a book published by that book,
His niece Mary Trump.
No, Mary Trump is very interesting because Mary Trump,
she lived
in that family, and she has insider's view. She's like a family therapist. She's very well trained, and her book, I've read her book, her conclusions are really sound. Theoretically, they're not wild speculations, and they're evidence-based.
Yeah, that's what I found in reading the book. Yeah. Like, I'm like we can, you know, as a person who's interested in a person's psychology of, right, you know, what is their mind state or what is right, their, you know, and how are they making decisions? And I mean, I was so scared during 2020 and 2021. Like every day I was just like, is our country going to fall off the cliff? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I just couldn't like get a handle on his psyche, you know, like, yeah, what is he going to do next? You know, right, he's so unpredictable. And right, in Mary Trump's book, it actually was very comforting.
Yes, because it, like, puts it into a rational context. You can understand from whence this personality comes with all, yes, of its damages and warts.
Yes.
And why he reacts, because he's entirely reactive, why he reacts to a given stimulus the way he does. He's quite predictable, actually. It's not, he's impulsive.
Very impulsive.
Yeah. So in that sense, you don't know what out of his bag of tricks he's going to do next. But if I said, if somebody who was formerly an ally of President Trump's criticizes him, what do you think his response is going to be? Everybody knows what his response is going to be. It's not a mystery.
Yeah, he's going to go after the person.
Right, exactly. give them nicknames and mock them, et cetera.
Well, I think that's where he's particularly creative. Yeah. Is where I don't know what kind of concoction he's going to make up next.
Right.
But it's like so bizarre and right, out there.
Right.
It's like, that's what I find like unpredictable. I mean, in his behavior, yeah, I know that he's gonna, it's like a bad date, you know, a guy you're dating, and the more information you get about him, the more, you know, it's like worse and worse. And so I'm like, how much worse can this get? Like,
it can get worse and worse.
There you go. So that's why we're all up in arms and concerned about our democracy, because he will stop at nothing. Yes. It seems,
in that sense, he's also quite predictable. If something is transactionally in his personal interest, that's what he will do. Regardless of norms, regardless of the law, regardless of the needs of the nation or of individuals in the nation, is it in his transactional interest? And his whole family, I heard Mary Trump say on television last week that three generations of the family are transactional. everything is transactional. She was addressing why is no family, why are his kids not at his trial? Because there's nothing in it for them. That's transactional. That's the nature of the family. Just
wow.
Ask the transactional question and you'll answer it. And you'll understand why various Trumps do what they do or don't do what they do. She's fabulous. She is like a light in the darkness.
Yeah, that's what I found.
Yeah.
And you're adding some enlightenment as well. If you look at what they're doing and who's showing up when, their family system is about transactions.
Right. Yeah. Is there something in it for me?
You know, yeah.
That's why the former president said outrageous things to his chief of staff, who was a retired general, his father, whose son had been killed in combat. It was astounding that he said it, not even that he thought it was bad enough, but astounding that he said, you know, why would GIs do this? Why, you're a loser if you, you know, why would you risk your life? For what? What's the benefit in that to the individual soldier who's responding to his or her duty and risking their lives in the service of their country? It seems like a terrible business proposition from his perspective.
Yeah.
You know, it's all risk, no gain. So why would you do it? But to say that to a former retired general who was his chief of staff, whose son had been killed within the last several years, it was an extraordinary tone deafness, which you also find in this individual.
I think it is at the intersection of behavior and law, we're kind of baffled with. And I would like to talk in our next conversation about if you're comfortable with it. I mean, we've got some other questions that I'd like to also get to. But in this particular case, it shows in such a huge degree how far an individual goes to get their way.
Yes.
And there's all these mile markers and all the delays. I mean, if you're smart enough and you're getting enough legal advice,
hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, on lawyer after lawyer after lawyer. Yeah. Yes. You can work the system. That's, you know, a cynical position is all the justice that money can buy. Because the system can be worked. The system is imperfect.
And that's where I feel, let's just talk about this right now, because I don't think we can come back into it without a disruption here. I just feel like, how do we fix this system? You know, now that we're given all the ways that this is the gift that I feel in Donald Trump's past presidential run-up and just following his legacy, no one has written as much about any president as him, I think, and exploiting the legal system at one level and angle to another, and always being able to delay, although I'm seeing the system at some point kind of catches up to you. But I'm I hope that all of us, with given the gift, the horrific gift that we've been given of how someone can exploit our legal system and on all different levels, in all different ways, and get away with it. I just feel like I hope that we really sew up these loopholes and, you know, the presidential immunity. You should, you know, the minute you leave the White House, you should not have presidential immunity. But anyways, I mean, there's the layperson input, and then there's how the system works and how can we make it so that it's more accountable. And what you want to say, so go ahead and respond to that. I'm interested.
I think, first of all, one of the things that Donald Trump demonstrated is how much of the rule of law is based on norms and not laws, even though he violated laws. You know, he violated the emoluments law, where you're supposed to not be able to monetize the presidency, which he did with impunity, right down to the Trump Hotel, where people who wanted access from other countries to the president of the United States would stay in his hotel. That ka-ching would go into his pocket. But all kinds of things where he monetized the presidency, and that's illegal. There were laws there, but they weren't enforced. However, much of how presidents operated since George Washington was based on a gentleman's understanding or gentlewoman's understanding of what are the norms, what do you do, what do you not do, not what are the codified rules. So, you know, the fact that he could do, well, let's take the immunity issue.
Yeah.
It gets more complicated even than that, because there has been, in my judgment, a corrupting of the judicial system. So we have if you follow precedent, my understanding, not being a lawyer, is there was no basis for even giving certiorari, that means giving a hearing at the Supreme Court level, to the question of total immunity. But three of the justices he nominated, and they were carefully selected through a system that the right had operating of vetting justices who would support ending Roe v. Wade. So they came from a carefully selected group of people who, whether or not you agree with their views on Roe v. Wade, had an allegiance to him that in the past, even justices who were appointed by a president of one party might evolve while they were on the bench and become very different kinds of voices than would have been expected by the president who nominated them to the Supreme Court. But these three are loyalists. And then Justice Thomas has no business sitting on any of these issues, because his wife was at January 6th and was texting the chief of staff of President Trump during the insurrection and cheering on the notion that this was a fake election and that Trump really won. He has such a contamination in this case. Any justice at any lower court who is subject to rules and ethics would have to recuse themselves, or one side or another could move that they recuse themselves, and that could be appealed to a higher court. But the Supreme Court has had no effective ethic rules, and now that they have a facsimile of them, they have no enforcement. So it's outrageous that the Supreme Court has a justice who is the potential reproach of being biased, because if any judge who is, any judge wants to be above reproach, whether or not they're biased, they want, if there is evidence that they may well be biased, they recuse themselves. But the Supreme Court doesn't have that. So you have this very biased and, in a sense, corrupted Supreme Court today. And not surprisingly, the public holds the Supreme Court in its lowest esteem at historically ever. So that's a real problem here. That's why you get a Supreme Court that hears a question that's an absurd question of absolute immunity. Trump's attorney argued in front of the D.C. Court of Appeals, which is the second highest court in the land. It's not like all the other circuit courts. It's kind of higher than that, who unanimously said there is no absolute immunity. He argued that, yes, he could call upon the Navy SEALs to murder his political opponent, and unless he was successfully impeached, he could not be held accountable for this. It's an absurd position. It's a kind of position you'd make on the other side to make the point.
Right.
So why would the Supreme Court even, having a really carefully thought through and unanimous opinion from the D.C. Court of Appeals. Why would they even take this case? And then when they took it, they rewrote the question. So it wasn't, does the president have absolute immunity, which is what he's arguing. It was, in what instances might the president have some kind of immunity? That wasn't the question.
Yeah.
It's so transparently an effort at the very least to delay the trial till after the election that this kind of bias is unacceptable. And it's never existed in modern times at the court level. I don't know enough about the history of the court, whether in the 18th century there was, or 19th century there was other periods when the court was corrupted. But I think the issue is, we need more rules for sure, but it's also enforcing the rule of law. And if you don't have an effective judicial system, or if you have a corrupted judicial system, then enforcing the rule of law becomes increasingly difficult. And that's what all dictators want and achieve. You know, and they even in Israel, you know, Netanyahu has been trying to transform the independence of the Supreme Court there, which is the only check and balance institution. They have a parliamentary system. They don't have three branches of government that are supposed to be checks on each other. The only check is the Supreme Court, and he's trying to replace the justices because, big surprise, he's been indicted for corruption himself.
Yeah. Wow, you're offering so much clarity and inspiration and to help us understand, you know, navigate through these next number of months, because we are like, how is the rule of law being enforced and why is it being stretched to the degree that it is? And the corruption and how it's being infiltrated into our system is really quite alarming. So there's a lot more to learn.
Well, is there time for me to point? One of the things we're talking about, Donald Trump's predictability versus his impulsivity and unpredictability. One thing that's always predictable, Donald Trump projects. That is, he attributes to the other the very thing that he does.
Yes. Yes.
It's corrupt Joe Biden. It's crime family Joe Biden.
Right. He can just turn the finger around to himself and it would be fitting. Yeah.
Right. So his attacks, his relentless attacks on our rule of law and judicial system are, it's corrupt. It's uniquely unfair to him. He's not getting the same kind of fair justice that anybody else should get. What's the truth there? He's getting actually special justice. He's getting exceptions that no other defendant would ever get in any court. Just his, in the New York City courtroom, his gag order violations.
15 of them.
Five earlier would have landed him in jail. But, you know, but the exception is made over and over and over again in his judicial proceedings of, but he's an ex-president. That the whole point of no one's above the law, including the president, mitigates against that. But
yeah,
one of the points is that whenever he's accusing other people of anything, just return it to him. This is a projection. This is the truth about him, which he says, it's not me, it's him. It's the other person.
It's a good place to finish out our conversation. Thank you for this wonderful conversation. It's been so insightful, and thanks for taking the time to make this happen. Thanks, you listener, for tuning in, and we'll see you in the next conversation.
If you want to expand your leadership skills and become more resilient and competent as a business owner, do you want to bring more meaning to your relationships and more purpose to your business? Are you ready to take charge of how you innovate, create, and run your business? Our dual innovation leadership process will help you redefine how you lead as you redesign your business. We collaborate with you to do what will work for you as you evolve and change. We start with where you are, whether you are turning around a financial crisis, growing to the next level, or somewhere in between.
We address your immediate needs, shore up business development gaps, expand relational literacy, and build upon your entrepreneurial leadership skill sets with a short-term results orientation and a long-term perspective. Start by subscribing to this podcast at wementor.com or anywhere you listen to your podcasts. If you are ready to hire a mentor, contact me at nancy@wementor.com. When we mentor, you create better life and a more fulfilling future. As an entrepreneurial leader / innovator, as a competent business owner / practitioner, as a mentor / role model, and as a human being courageously living a meaningful life. As Gandhi said, be the change you wish to see in the world. Get involved today. It's never too late to change your life and how you lead.